Scripture shapes the lives of millions of people around the world. Yet scriptures, both the Bible and the Quran, only gain meaning when they are interpreted by the human mind. Minding Scripture, a podcast from the Department of Theology at the University of Notre Dame, explores the meeting of reason with the scriptures of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. My name is Zvi Novik. I'm a professor of Jewish thought and culture at Notre Dame. And we have the pleasure of speaking today with a guest to the podcast, but a colleague in the Department of Theology at Notre Dame, Professor Gary Anderson. Gary is the Hesburgh Professor of Catholic Thought, specializing in the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. He's one of the world's leading scholars of the Hebrew Bible, and in particular, a foremost expositor of what it means to read the Old Testament as Catholic scripture. He has authored such creative and significant books as A Time to Mourn, A Time to Dance, The Expression of Grief and Joy in Israelite Religion, way back in 1991, The Genesis of Perfection, Adam and Eve in Jewish and Christian Imagination, 2001, also rather distant, Charity, The Place of the Poor in the Biblical Tradition, in 2013, and most recently, Christian Doctrine and the Old Testament Theology in the Service of Biblical Exegesis, in 2017. But the book of most immediate interest to us today was one that Professor Anderson published in 2009, Sin, A History. Now, if we do a podcast about a book, it's usually about a book that came out recently, but some topics never go out of style, and sin is one of them. And perhaps, too, a book is a bit like a child, and we actually learn to know it better after it's grown up some, walked about in the world, faced some adversity. Not too much adversity, mind you. It's been received enthusiastically and is really already, if I may say so, something of a classic. And so, without further ado, to our topic for today, Sin in Jewish and Christian Scripture, and especially through the prism of Gary's book, Sin, A History. And let me start with the title, Gary. Perhaps there were some disappointed buyers who didn't read the Amazon reviews and thought they'd be getting the vicarious thrill of reading about great sinners in history. But that's not really what this book is about, is it? Right? What do you mean by a history of sin?
So that's a great question. As some of the listeners may know, titles are never wholly in the possession of the author. It's always a negotiation with the publisher. And one of the things one wants, or at least I want to achieve when I publish a book, is to have the book priced at a level at which ordinary people can buy it, not just libraries. I'm actually terrible with titles. I can't remember what I proposed, but it was long and ridiculous. Yale came up with Sin, A History, and basically said, if you want the price point to be under $30, we need a title like this. And I wasn't hard to twist my arm. I accepted the title because I think it's fair to the essential, one of the essential, themes of the book, even though I think the title perhaps for a lot of readers promises more than they're going to get. But the reason why I accepted the title is actually, I think reflective of the basic, thesis of the book, which is when we move from the prime period of the Old Testament Hebrew Bible, what we call the First Temple period, the kind of Hebrew that makes up, the bulk of the Christian Bible, we have an enormous, sea change in the language, the Hebrew language, Aramaic language, and the conception of sin. So what the book really tries to trace is how we move from a world in which the predominant metaphor is that of sin as a weight or a burden to a world in which the predominant metaphor is that of sin as a debt. And Sin, A History, I think, is a good title because the break is, almost complete. I mean, you find almost no debt imagery in the Hebrew Bible itself. There is some, but very little. And the, burden imagery, though it does continue into the New Testament and rabbinic thought, it's clearly a muted and really kind of citation metaphor, we might want to say, rather than something that's, you know, truly productive.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I guess, so sin history is really then a history of how the biblical tradition thinks about sin. And in particular, I guess you described these metaphors, metaphorical frameworks for thinking about sin. So we've got sin as burden earlier in the Bible, and then sin as debt emerging later. And right, it's really, I suppose, right, one of the things that really intrigued me, I remember in reading the book first, was to think about sin, how we tend to think about sin nowadays, and right, whether we use metaphors for sin nowadays. I'd like to return to those to those metaphors, of course, that dominate in the Bible, the sin as burden and sin as debt. But what about, what do you think about nowadays? I mean, it doesn't strike me that when we think about sin, we're thinking about it in either of those terms. Or do you see us as using metaphors for sin nowadays? Or do we just not tend to talk about sin all that much altogether? What do you think
That's a great question. I mean, I think for me, I think we'd have to take a step back with respect to the question as you pose it. I mean, very influential when I began thinking about this topic for me was Paul Ricoeur's book, The Symbolism of Evil, in which he essentially made, I mean, I think he had all the wrong evidence, but he made essentially a theme or thesis that I wanted to argue, which is that there's no way of speaking about matters with respect to God, the intelligible world, we might want to say, without recourse to, you know, sensible material things. It's very basic, let's say, to St. Thomas's, you know, Summa Theologica, that, you know, theological language is replete with metaphor because there's no other way to speak about otherworldly matters. As rational animals, that's what we require. Now, what happens, and you know this probably better than I, is though all of these images that, you know, are so basic and fundamental to religious life begin as very concrete, specific metaphors, but many of them, you know, lose that sense over time. And so native speakers don't necessarily retain the etymological sense of these words. I can think of a great example of that from my teaching. We watch always in my freshman theology class, this fantastic movie Of Gods and Men about these monks in Algeria who end up dying on behalf of the Arab villagers in which they live. But the chief figure writes this extraordinary letter. It's actually very influenced by Emmanuel Levinas, deep use of the metaphor, we might want to say, of the face. But in talking about meeting the face of his assailant, he says he wants to bid him in French, it's adieu, which means just goodbye. But he clearly is playing on its etymological sense, you know, to God. Right. And I remember explaining this in my class, and I always have a lot of native Spanish speakers. And so I said to them, well, how do you say, you know, goodbye in Spanish? Well, adios, of course. And I say, well, what does that mean? And they say, goodbye. I said, no, adios. That they have that felt sense, you know, of what, you know, it literally means, which is true, and certainly would be true for, you know, terms of sin coming into the modern world. Many people don't think of their origins, but, you know, this is a long-winded answer. I'm sorry, but to come back maybe to the point, I think everybody has some material image of either consciously reflected on or not, of what, you know, of what a sin is and what it would take to remove or ameliorate the effects of sin. I would say in the modern world, probably it's the world of therapy, I think, that colors the way in which most people think of this topic or reject the topic on the basis of therapy.
Well, that's interesting, right? So I guess, right, the question is, to what extent is it that, say, a sin is being thought of as a the sort of problem to be cured through therapy, or to what extent are they, right, no longer thinking of sin? I suppose that's a tricky thing.
If I could give just one other example I use from my teaching, it actually is you know, incredibly relevant now in the world of Black Lives Matter, but I used it long before the current, you know, crisis in race relations. And I lectured on Original Sin, I always use this address that then candidate Obama gave in Philadelphia, probably 6 months before he was elected, in talking about, you know, the founders of this country. He used, I don't remember the exact phrase, I mean, the exact sentence, but the phrase he used was the original stain of slavery. I always tell the students that, you know, well, this is a really striking phrase by President Obama, because normally he, you know, didn't invoke religious vocabulary in his, you know, public speeches. But here he clearly is alluding to not only original sin, but sin as a stain. Now, why does he do both of those things? Well, you know, he needs a conceptual world in which the legacy of sin can be conceived of as transgenerational. And a stain, the difficulty of removing a stain, sometimes right. The impossibility of removing a stain, is fundamental to what he wanted to say about the transgenerational effects of human sin. And that's the kind of work I think metaphor does. That's the notion that, you know, you've done something wrong, okay, but we want to be able to conceive of wrongdoing in such a way that how we express it, formulate it, can capture, for example, that some, you know, wrongs that we do are going to perdure, they're going to last, even if we, you know, confess them, the effects simply don't disappear.
Kind of indelibility. Yeah. Right. And I suppose that is one metaphor, right? That one certainly finds in the Bible of sin as stain that, that one does find then popping up even today. So I wonder, I mean, as you were talking, it occurred to me then if we're talking about a procession of metaphors and a range of different metaphors, is there a there? Like, what is the can we speak then of an underlying idea of sin that that can be a criterion then for judging whether a certain metaphor is better than another? I think when you were getting into the question of therapy, you were kind of maybe suggesting that if we're using that metaphor for the problem and then and the solution, then we are departing in significant ways from a more traditional conception. So yeah, how do we think about that? I mean, if we're always cloaking this concept in metaphor, then do we have a there?
I think that's a very good question. I guess I would put as a result or on the basis of my own work, that's not a question that I've asked in any kind of serious way, but I guess I might come back with an answer that's not fully an answer. I guess I would say that the metaphors certainly that are deployed in the Bible, each one has the ability, we might want to say, to convey some aspects of what constitutes human sin as opposed to others. So, some metaphors. So, for example, and again, correlation doesn't mean causation, but for me, it's hardly accidental that we have in the book of Daniel this notion of human sin extending over hundreds of years. And it's linked to imagery of sin that's, you know, financial and debt related. That's not hard to understand. I mean, debt instruments until they're paid off, last. It's not by accident that when we looked at all the texts we have from the ancient Near East or the Judean desert or what have you, they're not the texts that most people want to discover. It's not Gilgamesh, the Bible. They're usually legal texts. They're the texts that we put in safety deposit boxes, right? They're your mortgage deed, your marriage license. These are the things that people, take great care to store, even today. And so it's no accident that when we, discover them in antiquity, that's what we discover. And debt instruments are one of the things we do discover. So I think, that's one of the, the dead as burden image can capture that too. Stain can capture it, but I think that the debt image works fantastic for that. And the other thing the debt image works really well for is it has a natural correlate in virtue language, that is of treasury and heaven. So that notion of debt one owes as opposed to virtue one accumulates.
Right, right.
We still have that same process in the Bible without those metaphors. But once the metaphors are in place, there's an incredible synergy that then takes place.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and I want to get back to that virtue correlate and that treasury in heaven and bore down a little bit more into this idea of sin as debt. But I think what I hear you saying to some extent is that there is a kind of continuity among some of these metaphors that point toward the underlying idea. I mean, this is a crude way of, I guess, of speaking of whatever it is that's lying behind that, these metaphors in which we cloak or give expression to, or really see some true aspect of sin. And I guess that common denominator, one of those common denominators, I guess, that you were singling out is that idea of endurance, right? So in the case of the stain, that endurance over generations. And then in the case of sin as debt, you have debt instruments that are recorded and that you keep in a safe deposit box. And so both even as these are quite distinct metaphors and can have their own implications and be spun out in different ways, there are these interesting correlates. I think also, there's been a lot of discussion in the news about student debt. And I think, a term that's used often in that context is burden, the burden of student debt. So there you kind of have a certain overlap between debt, sin as burden, and sin as debt also.
One small footnote, but I think it's very important that I think it needs to be on the table. A lot of people, when they think of the metaphors that generate religious ideas, they think of metaphor in terms of, you know, what a really good writer might generate, a good poet, for example, and certainly that's true. What my book is tracing is slightly different. The metaphors that I'm interested in are the ones that are given by the dictionary. In other words, they're not subject to the kind of creative flourish of this writer or that. But, you know, if you look up in a dictionary for Mishnaic Hebrew or Jewish Aramaic or Christian Aramaic, you'll see that the word for sin is chov. You know, it's not, we don't have to have some genius poet use that as a flourish in his liturgical poetry. That's something you get, at your mother's breast. It's what you learn in a kind of, almost unreflective sense. And that's also, I think it's important to realize that, in my book, what I'm tracing are kind of metaphors that are cultural givens, that they're not the kind of work of genius of an individual writer. And they're metaphors that, exist and influence Jewish and Christian literature, over centuries. So again, common metaphors that we think of don't necessarily have that, that kind of durative capacity, and they have that durative capacity because they're part of the language, right? They're not
right. Mm-hmm.
They're not flourishes of great writers.
So that's interesting. So it's kind of like a sweet spot between kind of individual genius, the kind of the romantic poet on the one hand, and then on the other hand, dead metaphor that's become kind of so much integrated, as it were, into the language that we no longer think of it as a metaphor. But here we're talking about something that's part of the lexical space, of the conceptual space of a culture. But at the same time, people are conscious of it, of the resonances and the real metaphor here that the metaphor matters. That's interesting, right?
Exactly.
So let's get. I'd like to follow up more about the sin as burden metaphor before turning to the sin as debt metaphor, which I think is fair to say is really the main preoccupation of the book. So this is the metaphor that predominates in the First Temple period. And then the sin as debt metaphor emerges are in the Second Temple period. So we're talking here roughly the first half of the first millennium BC, and then the second half. And this is this question, I guess, goes to some of the ideas that we were just talking about in terms of metaphor and what's behind the metaphor and what it means to speak metaphorically. So this idea of sin as burden, how seriously do you think ancient Israelites took this metaphor? I mean, was it just a metaphor? And I'm thinking by analogy of ritual defilement. So according to the Bible, for example, as you well know, someone who touches a corpse becomes defiled. And then if she enters the temple, then that defilement can contaminate the temple. Right. And one might think of ritual defilement as just a metaphor, right? It's just a way that the culture is expressing the idea that the biblical God is a God of life. And so there needs to be a separation from death. But I think it's fair to say that biblical scholarship tends to want to push back on that idea and to say, no, the ancient Israelites thought of ritual defilement as a real thing. A miasma, an invisible substance, what have you. And so what about sin as burden, and maybe even sin as debt too, if you'd like to consider that here as well. When the ancient Israelites are thinking about sin as a burden, do they mean to, is that merely a metaphor, or are they thinking of it almost as having a metaphysics with a substance?
So that's a sense of that. Yeah. That's a good point. So maybe just one aside, unrelated to your question, but I wanted to include it. I don't know if you know this movie. It's a fantastic movie called The Mission, about the Jesuits in South America.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful movie. Actually, the score is incredible. I'm sure you know some of the tunes in the score. The Italian Morricone, I can't remember his name. Anyways, it's fantastic. But there's a great scene that, and it's a beautiful movie because it's about basically the Spanish colonial oppression of Native Americans in Latin America. But the Jesuits here, as you might imagine, come out looking pretty good. But in one of the scenes, one of the mean-spirited, Spanish colonialists who's been, brutal to the Native Americans, wants to repent of his actions and, be released from his sins by a priest. And they show him scaling this enormous rock face with all of the weapons that he had used to basically, torture these people on his back. And the word of forgiveness, when he asks for forgiveness from those he's oppressed, what they do is that they cut the burden off of his back and he stands up. It's really quite beautiful. Anyways, unrelated, obviously, to the Bible, but I saw that movie while I was writing the book. So it was one of those images that really stuck deeply in me. To answer your question, I would say, as you know, my book is more committed certainly to the dead imagery, and I can explain why that's the case. How active did the burden metaphor, or how productive was it in First Temple literature? Well, it certainly was productive to a certain degree. We have in Isaiah this image of Israel being kevadavon, struggling under the weight of her sins, wanting to offload it onto oxen carts and carry it, or Ezekiel lying on his side and having the sins of Israel put upon him, or certainly the Yom Kippur rite. But it doesn't cover everything. And certainly you've just put your finger on, a very important exception in what we call the priestly literature, where the predominant metaphor is certainly that of sin as a stain. And I would accept, certainly on the basis of Jacob Milgram's work, that the etymology of lekaper in Hebrew comes from the Akkadian kupuru, which means to wipe off. And that the rites of, atonement that we see, for example, in Leviticus 4 and 5, as well as the rites of purification for, the parturient and the rest, that these are, rites of purification. Milgram always likes to have everything, reduced to a tidy system. I'm not quite as Milgromian there, but he wants to say with respect to Leviticus 16, for example, the Day of Atonement, that the blood acts as a kind of ritual detergent, removing miasma, as you put it. from all the elements of the, you know, the inside of the temple or tabernacle where it, you know, is drawn to. And then it's offloaded onto this, you know, beast of burden and carried out into the wilderness. So there's a kind of, you know, magical transformation, you might want to say, of all of this sin that exists at one level as a kind of a miasma of impurity that becomes a burden that then an animal can carry out. How that works, I don't know. I guess I'm a little bit more suspicious there. I don't think that all ritual kind of, you know, can be reduced to, you know, a simple, a simple picture book without, you know, with no difficulties.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned a picture book, right? As you were talking, I was thinking about, my reference, my cultural reference points are considerably lower brow. Reading to my kids, The Cat in the Hat Comes Back, right? Which is about the spot, right? That has to be continually transferred. Right. When you get rid of it, you only end up transferring it to another spot. But you're pointing to, I guess, a continuity between precisely that idea of ritual defilement, which biblical scholarship does tend to take as a real thing and not just as a metaphor, and the idea of sin as burden, because you do see one of the, I guess, the flagship instances, as you say, is this idea of what people call the scapegoat, idea of placing the sins that have been, as it were, wiped off the temple onto the back of this goat and sending into the wilderness. And that, right, might suggest, some kind of metaphysics here of a burden.
I think the other place, I've never fully satisfied to my own mind how all of this works. I mean, actually, I hope will be, you know, part of the next book I write. But the story of the release of Israel from the sin of the golden calf in Exodus 32 to 34, and then its mirror image in the story of the spies in Numbers 13 and 14, plays back and forth between this image of forgiveness, Nasa Avon, but also God bearing Israel, you know, through the wilderness, both as, you know, his responsibility, but there's also, you know, a tinge there of the notion of God carrying Israel's sins. Yohanan Mufs alludes to this in his classic article on the subject. But I think it would really be worth, you know, a more careful scrutiny and attention, which I haven't given it. But I think what's interesting about that, too, is that Nasa Avon can also have this sense of liability. I think that's behind the biblical notion of expressing liability with the preposition al, you know, alai la'asot, you know, I have to do something.
It is upon me.
It's upon me, right? Yeah. And I think, I also think that this notion of masa in the, you know, as a prophetic oracle also has that sense of, you know, an obligation. I don't want to go to the mat on this, but it strikes me as very probable. And in that sense, it's actually similar to the way chov and chayav work. I mean, chayav simply can be, I have to do something. Something is, I must do something, like a lie in Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, that is.
Right.
So they're different metaphorical fields, but they're doing, you know, similar work.
Yeah, and intersecting given. Yeah, one thinks also, I think, of the, in terms of bearing burdens, certainly in the ancient Near Eastern context, encompassing the Hebrew Bible too, one has the slave who bears a burden. And then when we turn to sin as debt, of course, we also pick up debt slaves. And so, yeah, you have all these interesting intersections. Well, we should turn to sin as debt, but I think also this is a good point to take a break. And this is also an opportunity then for listeners to review and rate our podcast. But we will be back momentarily. Welcome back to Minding Scripture. We're speaking with Gary Anderson, the Hesburgh Professor of Catholic Thought at the University of Notre Dame, about sin in Scripture, and in particular about his book, Sin, A History. And as you mentioned, the main burden of the book, no pun intended, I suppose, is to describe the sin as debt, and the emergence of this new metaphor and its implications for Judaism and for Christianity. So maybe we could turn to that then now. When does this metaphor sin as debt arise? And why does it arise when it does?
So I'm going to be just slightly autobiographical here, if you don't mind.
Oh, please.
it's related to the strange, you know, path I followed in scholarship. I went to graduate school. My intention and all of my coursework was devoted to the First Temple period, Assyriology, Semitics, blah, blah, blah. but at the end of my time as a graduate student, this professor from Yale showed up by the name of James Kugel. Mm. And I ended up being a TA for him in a course that eventually would, you know, have a thousand, you know, Harvard undergraduates in it. And for me, it was kind of life-changing, the way in which, how the Bible is transforms in the, you know, Second Temple period and forward. And I started to develop, really started to retrain and retool myself. I mean, I'd already written my dissertation, which is complete. I would never write a dissertation like that today. But I started immediately kind of remaking myself as soon as the ink was dry. And it also coincided happily with my first job, which was at the University of Virginia, where they had a graduate program, not by accident, you know, Christianity and Judaism and Antiquity like ours, because the person who started it at Notre Dame had gone to Virginia. Any event, long story short, I had to teach a course on the Dead Sea Scrolls. I never read a Dead Sea Scroll, so I started reading. So I better read this before I teach it. And I remember being stuck in the Damascus document because there was this sentence with respect to the forgiveness of the sins of David. The verb used in Hebrew was azav, azav lo el. And I knew that according to sense, this had to mean, you know, that David was forgiven. But that word doesn't mean that. That, you know, if you open up your biblical Hebrew dictionary, you can go all the way down, you know, the entry, and you won't find forgiveness anywhere. And that's really when I realized, so sin had a history, right? I'm in a new world. I realized I'm a completely new world. But what occurred to me, I was also reading Syriac then because I was interested in early interpretation. Mm-hmm. And as probably any Christian Bible reader knows, both the Hebrew and Aramaic of Psalm 22, because Jesus cites them on the cross, and the Greek, you know, transliterates, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. And so I was thinking, you know, how could azav mean forgive? And then I thought, well, shavak in Aramaic, that's translating Hebrew azav in Psalm 22, and that's exactly, you know, what we have here. This must be what linguists call a calc, that is, they're thinking in one language but writing in another. And frequently, you know, people who do that, you know, no matter how gifted they are, will occasionally slip up, and you know, the one language will influence or color the other. And I think that's what was happening in the Damascus document. But then I started realizing that this wasn't just one word. This was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And New Testament scholars themselves note, for example, in the famous Lord's Prayer, as Catholics call it, the Our Father, the word for sin there is debt. And the word forgiveness means to forgive a debt. It's translated in Aramaic, the peshitta, the shvak, the same word. And New Testament scholars have noted the same problem, that this, in Greek, this doesn't make sense. You know, a Greek speaker wouldn't, you know, have resonated with these metaphor choices that Jesus uses in the Gospels. Mm-hmm. They only make sense if understood against, you know, an Aramaic or Hebrew background. So that was my story, but also how I came to, I think, you know, the Bible story. But reading the Syriac was deeply influential on me, because there I saw that all the stories that these writers, you know, created to describe, for example, the atonement, how does Jesus, you know, affect forgiveness of sins for humanity at large, were all dependent on this sin as debt metaphor, and that the most important verse in the entire New Testament, actually for all patristic writers, Greek, Latin, and Syriac, comes from Colossians, which you'd never guess from modern biblical commentaries, but Colossians 2:14 was the go-to verse, and it reads that Christ annuls the chirographon in Greek, which would be shtar in Hebrew, the contract, the debt instrument that was held against us. That verse if you look at, you know, Biblia Patristica, which is the kind of, you know, citation index for all of patristic literature, right. I mean, it just goes on for pages. And what I discovered as I read this material is that, you know, those citation indexes won't do Colossians justice because the words of that verse become the vocabulary of the writers themselves. So they won't, you don't always know when they're citing the verse or when the verse simply becomes how they talk about the atonement, if you know what I mean. And so it really became clear to me that, you know, this was by no means a dead metaphor. It wasn't like adios. It wasn't like you had to inform the native speaker what the word meant. Actually, goodbye has the same sense in English if you do I had never realized that. But anyways, this metaphor, I realized, really did work. And what really interested me, too, because I was reading rabbinics then at the same time, was actually reading, you know, Bavli Horayot. So it was deeply embedded in sin, let's say. But when I was learning rabbinic Hebrew at the same time, so I was spending a lot of time in the rabbinic dictionary, and I saw that these words, they're all the same, you know, the Jewish words and the Christian words, not just one word, but all the words. It was amazing to me. It still kind of flabbergasts me. And that the stories that the two traditions will then use to talk about the forgiveness of sins. Well, obviously they're different. There's no Jesus in the Talmud, but the dynamics are so similar. Oh my goodness, it's incredible. You just kind of slightly, you know, you put in Jesus, take out Jesus, but you get almost the same, you know, the same thought world. And that, I don't know that I'm always been interested in Judaism. So that to me was just an incredible find too. And I suppose amazes me to this day.
And it's the same. So you say the same thought world because I suppose because ultimately they have the same metaphorical conceptualization. Great. And so I mean you mentioned this being bound up in language, of course, right? So when we're talking about metaphor, these metaphors are firmly rooted in language, and really it's this observation about a single word that sets you off this, sets you on this path. And so part of that background then we're talking about is the emergence of different language influences, right? You mentioned Aramaic. Right. And then you also mentioned, Syriac being a form of Aramaic
dialect.
An Aramaic dialect. I suppose is one of the arguments of this book then that insofar as metaphor is bound up with language and metaphors can then be lost in translation, that then we have a greater continuity with the world of the Old Testament among Christians who spoke Jesus's language or a version of that, namely these Syriac-speaking Christians. Does that follow then that they are kind of retaining something important about the conceptual world of Jesus and the earliest followers of Jesus that is then occluded in among Greek and Latin-speaking Christians?
I think that's accurate. I think, though, you have to make a couple of very important, provisos here. Mm-hmm. There are kind of romanticists, we might want to say, in the world of Syriac Christianity who will say, you know, that this is, you know, Jesus spoke Aramaic, this is Aramaic. And so if we want to get right to the heart of the New Testament, we have to go through the Syriac world. I'm not saying that. there is a certain naivete there that I don't share. But what I would want to say, I wouldn't want to deny all of that either. In other words, what I think is really valuable about reading the Syriac fathers on issues like the atonement, what have you, not that they capture exactly, let's say, what Colossians 2:14 was for whoever authored that epistle or the Lord's Prayer, what have you, but they retain, you know, that metaphorical world that the New Testament itself was created in. To that degree, yes, there's a kind of, authenticity to it that I think is really worth attending to.
Right,
but maybe one little footnote here too.
Sure, please, of course.
Some New Testament scholars will say, and again, I don't think they're sufficiently attentive to the fact that this metaphor long precedes the writing of the New Testament and will, you know, go on long afterwards. And they'll over-historicize Jesus' choice to use this imagery with respect to the socioeconomic conditions of Palestine in first century, AD. Now, that all might be true. I mean, the fact that, you know, Jesus wants to use these images of debt release and that there was, oppressive, debt conditions. I don't want to deny that, but I don't think you also can move in that kind of facile fashion just from the metaphor Jesus uses to some implied, socioeconomic critique of the Roman world, because the language that Jesus uses as recorded in the Gospels, as I mentioned, long precedes him and long, follows him. And it clearly can resonate outside of, whatever the specific circumstances of first century, Palestine were.
Right. That's interesting. So you'd want to kind of push back against the idea of kind of locating it as maybe a specific innovation connected with socioeconomic conditions in Roman Palestine. But on the other hand, I guess, right, one does, there is an importance to the metaphor, and the metaphor does have, say for those who are interested in the questions of poverty and economic consequences or economic kind of imperatives that follow from the gospel of the New Testament, right?
All of that works. It's very important to clarify. But I guess what I react against is the notion, again, it goes to the point that we were speaking of earlier, that it's not that Jesus doesn't choose this metaphorical field so that it can do that work. That metaphorical field is what he learns on his mother's knee.
But we
could say, the corrective that you add is certainly true, is that that metaphorical field does allow him then, and certainly the tradition, to make some very specific and pointed, observations about, debt release in the real world. I'm not denying that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I just want to overspecify the, level of intentionality here.
Right, right. And that's also has its implications, right, with the thinking about the breadth of it for, as you say, kind of links between emergent Christianity and emergent what we know of as Judaism today, rabbinic Judaism.
Which would tie back to some of the earlier questions you had. The importance of all of this, I think, is it really well illustrated in Josephus. I learned this from an article by a great historian of the Roman world, Jewish historian, Mr. Goodman from Oxford.
Martin Goodman.
He noted in an article that one of the first things that happened in the wake of the destruction of the temple in 70 was the euphoria that, all those debt instruments had been destroyed as well. Modern people, you're asking about, idioms in the modern world. I found in kind of shopping my book around, people are very uncomfortable with financial metaphors for religion. I think they think of Wall Street. They think of, all they think of is the kind of oppressive usages. They don't think, of what it would be like if you were actually suffering under a terrible debt instrument and it, burned up in a conflagration, what a great moment in time would that be? But I have to say, I've gotten a lot of letters from the Jewish readers of the book who tell me, what a profound impact the book had on them, because the prayers used in the fall liturgy frequently have reference to the Shitrei Chova, these sins conceived of as financial instruments that evidently, you'd know the world better than me, but there are many modern, observant Jews who find this distasteful is perhaps too strong, but certainly not to their liking.
Right.
And, I don't know, maybe the long reach of the Merchant of Venice. I don't know what accounts for this, but I've had many say that they, you know, they really appreciated that they could now say these prayers and see that there was a kind of, you know, beneficial, you know, and productive way of coming at the imagery.
Right. Yeah. That's very interesting, really, this question of, the implications of the book for thinking about, our perspective on finance and economics and that, of course, also, and perhaps we can get to this question of Catholic and Protestant receptions of the book, because I'd certainly be interested in hearing how that played out, perhaps maybe along similar lines as these different receptions among Christians generally and Jews. You mentioned earlier in our conversation that part of the payoff, again, well, that time no pun intended, but part of the payoff of the sin is debt metaphor is this correlate system of virtue connected with charity, and so that you're arguing in the book, if I understand correctly, that with the conceptualization of sin in terms of debt, then one can acquire kind of offsetting credit, as it were, through among other things, and perhaps even chiefly charity. So I'd like to hear maybe what you have to say about that dynamic. And in particular, I'm curious, would you say then that charity in the New Testament and then beyond into Christianity in general acquires its importance mainly as a corollary to the sin is debt metaphor? Or are there other factors, do you think, supporting the centrality of charity? I know you wrote a whole separate book on charity, what do you think about that aspect?
So I guess I go back to a phrase, a truism I mentioned earlier. Correlation isn't always causation, but I find it hard, you know, having made that, you know, observation. In the book, I find it hard to imagine that the kind of financial dimensions that are so basic to the way in which charity is imagined in the Second Temple period, that you know, arises without any relationship to the notion of sin as debt, which is emerging at the very same time. Mm-hmm. That being said, how the two are related one to the other is, you know, very complex, and one should add just from the very get-go that the virtue of charity is not reducible certainly to finances, what one does with finances. But mm-hmm. I think that's where the prestige lies, and I could turn to why I think that's the case if we wish in a moment. But I think that, you know, giving up your money is ultimately, you know, valued more highly than what we would call the corporal acts of mercy that you do with your person. But any event, the article that was truly very influential on me in this respect, and unfortunately, it's an article that is very rarely read because it was written in modern Hebrew, but was by the great, you know, grammarian at Hebrew University of Biblical Hebrew, Avigdor Hurwitz. He was trying to come up with reasons for how the Hebrew word tzedakah, which normally means righteousness, comes to mean charity in the late biblical and then, you know, Second Temple period. And he collected about a half dozen to a dozen texts, mainly from Proverbs and what we call wisdom psalms, in which we have these extraordinary, you know, juxtapositions, we might want to say, between the word tzedakah, righteousness, and then, you know, elements of finance. Mm-hmm. For him, this wasn't accidental, that this correlation of the two, Proverbs 10, Proverbs 11 would be a great example, where we have this contrast between hon, the Hebrew word hon for capital, wealth, what have you, the hoarding of it, the, you know, the improper attitude towards it, and then tzedakah in the parallel verse. Many people say it doesn't bear the meaning of charity there. I'd stand with Hurwitz and say, well, if it doesn't mean charity there, it's something very, very close. Mm-hmm. We're on the way. The problem with people who just kind of want to deny it because it's not absolutely certain, the problem with that, you know, we might want to say from a linguistic framework, is then you have no transition. It just comes out of nowhere. And that mm-hmm. clearly doesn't happen. There has to be some kind of, linguistic path by which this term emerges with the meaning it does. And Hurwitz, I think, documents that very nicely. So to get to that, why this is related to your question is that it shows us very early on that this term for charity that eventually can include, yes, works of corporal, mercy, not necessarily financially related, but its origins are tied, at least in Hurwitz's, account of the matter, in texts in which the financial element is front and center. But the other reason why it's so important too, and I probably didn't do good enough justice to this in my book, but mm-hmm. also something I learned from another Hebrew University professor. Oh my goodness, I'm blanking on his name right now. He's from the Netherlands, survived the Holocaust. I know his son, she's married to all, anyways, I think of everything about him. Why can't I think of his name? It doesn't matter. He wrote a really good book on loan language.
Moshe Weinfeld, are we talking?
Not Weinfeld. No.
Oh, okay.
He's a generation before. Anyways, doesn't matter. I'll remember after the podcast.
Of course.
It's not important. But the point he made in the article, and everybody knows this, is that poor relief in the Bible comes through non-interest loans. Right. And that's one of the reasons why then charity is going to be tied to the world of loans. The most important, chapter in the Bible, if you really want to see where all of this comes from, at least the Catholic Bible, would be Ben Sira, chapter, 29. I realized this pretty early on in my own research, and it was very understudied chapter. So I gave it to a doctoral student who wrote a fantastic dissertation on it. And if you really want to know where all this stuff comes from, I mean, that's the place to look. But Ben Sira 29 is one foot in the Bible, one foot in Deuteronomy 15, and then, one foot in the New Testament or, rabbinic writings. And I think I also learned from Eliezer Diamond on this score too. I mean, in his own book on, the Mishnaic law, that charity to the poor, at one level, yes, it's just another way of, money, giving money to the poor is just another way of being charitable, but there's also a kind of elevated prestige to it. My colleague at Harvard, I don't think he could establish this, but he's a very smart man, one of the smartest men I've ever met, Beryl Septimus, thought that the term zacha, to merit, when used, alone, referred principally to that, to the, giving of money to another person, that was the prestigious way to achieve merit in, rabbinic Judaism.
Uh-huh. So then we're talking here about a kind of a, I suppose the point is that this doesn't emerge from this financial metaphor for debt, kind of doesn't emerge from nothing, or it doesn't emerge kind of from without it has roots that are deeper than simply say the new prominence of Aramaic. Because we find kind of networks or echoes within on the virtue side of this with charity in already in Proverbs, and so we have a kind of a very large network of thinking about theological ideas in relation to finance, and so the web is pretty complex. You've mentioned a few times.
You pulled together my answer better than I did. I wanted to go 15 different directions, but I think you just answered your own question from the morass I gave you very well.
No, that was all.
The point is that charity, yes, has a deep point of origin, I think ultimately we want to see charity and sin in this period working synergistically in kind of synonym antonym way. But that doesn't mean that they, you know, from origin are simply twins, one of the other, and have no relationship or no integrated sense of their own.
Right, right, right. And it's great. It's interesting, really. Right. So it's easy, I guess maybe in the thrill of discovery to maybe try to oversimplify and say, right, we get sin as debt, and then charity emerges as the mirror financial image. But really, I guess when we dwell in it further, we realize that there's this complex web. I mean, you've mentioned rabbinic literature a few times already, and how you kind of read the reception of the Old Testament and the New in conversation with the reception of scripture, the interpretation of scripture in rabbinic literature. And I wonder just for you, and this is maybe to move beyond anything in the book, but is this for you, I mean, simply a matter of making use of available historical data? We have here kind of a corpus in a relevant language from roughly the right chronological period, or does this have broader theological implications for Jews and Christians today?
So probably would I want to answer this in three different planes. So at the autobiographical level, you know, as a person, I have an interest, affection, love for Judaism that is, you know, lishma for itself. So, that's not necessarily generalizable. I don't try to tell my students, for example, you know, somehow share this disposition of mine. That's just, you know, who I am. So that follows me in almost any research project I go in. So it's not not unique to this one. But what is generalizable beyond my, you know, just kind of personal, you know, story is, you know, the importance we might want to say of rabbinic literature for in giving us some handle on the Jewish background to the New Testament. That would certainly be true. I think, though I greatly, you know, respect much of the work of Jacob Neusner, I think one of the big disservices he did to biblical studies was essentially give every New Testament scholar a pass on rabbinic literature by saying it all is, you know, second, third century and beyond. That's all true, but, you know, I think certainly this debt language, when you look at it, you can see that, you know, well, okay, yes, the stories may be later, but the linguistic dynamic is, you know, very productive for understanding what's going on in the new. And I think that's just, a huge, you know, tragedy, we might want to say, for the field of New Testament studies. I mean, when I was being trained, now I'm going to give away my age, but one of the books, maybe one of the most influential scholarly books I ever read was E.P. Sanders' Paul and Palestinian Judaism in 1977. You would have thought, I mean, that, you know, and there's a man who devoted his whole life to reading rabbinic literature and, you know, yielded incredible insights into the New Testament. You'd think that would have been a cottage industry after E.P. Sanders, but it pretty much died with him. There's not very many people that can do what he does, certainly not Christians. So that's a sadness. So that's the second plane. Yes, I think it is incredibly useful for working in, you know, the materials of the Second Temple period or the New Testament. But the third plane, and really I would, you know, take from, you know, my favorite, you know, modern biblical scholar, Brevard Childs, who was way ahead of his time. He learned, you know, to read traditional Jewish commentaries in the 60s, long before it was fashionable to blue such. And he read rabbinic texts with Judah Golden when Judah Golden was at Yale. And for him, I also share this, and this is something that's very teachable. I think that rabbinic writings, but maybe more so the medievals, have great insights into what we would call the final canonical shape of the Hebrew Bible. And I think if you ignore them, you ignore them to your loss. There's all kinds of things that you can learn about the character of the Hebrew scriptures from attending to what they wrote. Not everything, of course. They don't think like moderns. They don't imagine literary sources. Yes, you have to make all kinds of corrections. But They have a profound, set of, theological lenses, but they also have a sense of just how what the final corpus, looks and what it means. And that to me is, very important. I think most modern, scholars of the Hebrew Bible will always nod to the truth of that, but there's very few who actually can open up those books and read them. That's a harder thing to accomplish.
Right. One could pursue that these lines of thought and these planes kind of for a while, but our time is running short. And so I wanted to end with a question, I guess, an appropriate telos, Christ. You've mentioned Colossians and how its conception of the crucifixion is informed by or is an expression of this sin as debt complex. I'd love to hear you say more just about what impact kind of appreciating the prevalence of the sin as debt metaphor should have or can have for Christian thought and perhaps specifically for Christology.
Great question. So one of the itches that this project scratched, it's kind of funny how things in your life, you think you've abandoned them, they're gone, and then they come back in a totally new way. When I was a divinity student getting my master's degree at Duke, the book we read, my systematic theology professor loved this book. He thought it was the be-all and end-all for the atonement. It was by a Swedish Lutheran thinker, Gustav Aulin, Christus Victor. Mm-hmm. And hugely important, influential book, maybe one of the most influential, books of the 20th century. But he argued that, the basic model that informs the atonement in patristic Christianity was that of Christ defeating Satan in a battle, hence the Christus Victor notion. It was a dramatic enactment of the defeat of evil. And he was a Lutheran, so for him, of course, this was the heart of the patristic tradition that Martin Luther recovers from the horrors of medieval, Catholicism. Well, when I read it as a divinity student, I wasn't hostile to Catholicism. I mean, I wasn't Catholic yet, but I don't know. That just, kind of all went over my head. I wasn't, too interested in that. But, as I started working on this project, I realized that, certainly with the Syriac Fathers, the Christus Victor theme was definitely the major motif, but the Christus Victor theme was, wholly dependent on this, debt imagery, which for Gustav Aulin, this was Anselm, and this is where, the Catholics went off the rails. So I guess for me, one of the things that was most surprising, and I have a long chapter I think it's the last chapter on Anselm, but actually my chapters on Narsai, Ephraim, and Jacob of Sarug are all about this as well, that the picture of the atonement that comes out of those writers is, wholly indebted, pun intended here, to this dead imagery. And it's not some kind of crazy medieval Catholic thing that just, destroys, the Christian tradition. It's there from the very beginning. And Aulin, couldn't see it because of his, his Catholic prejudices, but it's all over the place. And that, for me was just, that was like the scales falling from my eyes. It was incredible. I really, I like that. And I think it is, is it productive for Christian theology today? I don't know. I'll pass on that question. I spend so much of my time in antiquity. For me, what's productive is if I understand how they work, then I'm happy with it. Does it work today? I'm so embedded sometimes in the past, that's hard for me to know. I see why it's attractive in the past, so I find it attractive in the present. But that's probably
neurosis. Just briefly to follow up, I know I said that would be our last question, but to follow up on that, and to bring us to the present, in one way, of gauging this question of productivity is in terms of the reception of your own book. And I'm curious, I alluded earlier to this curiosity about Protestant readers. Have you heard from?
Yeah. No, it's been very, the book has been received very positively, more positively, ironically, than the charity book. But I think that's because Protestant readers, you know, I think they've liked it more than Catholic readers, because Protestant readers are very devoted to the problem of the atonement more than Catholics are. I don't know why that is. We probably have to ask Cyril O'Regan or someone. They could tell us. Francesca, if she was here, probably could tell us as well. But so that's been a point of deep attraction. I think they ignore, slide over the things I say about debt and how it would, you know, it interfaces eventually with, you know, indulgences and other things that come into play in the medieval period. But my Jewish colleagues, I mean, when I was writing this book, I gave innumerable talks on Israel, and my former teacher, Jim Kugel, was often there, and he'd always come up to me afterwards and, you know, say, oh, this is just like indulgences, because he was a scholar of, you know, Renaissance literature. He knew all of that stuff backwards and forwards. I think a lot of people missed, you know, that element of the book in the background, but, you know, Jim nailed it. Not everybody sees that, and I try not to front it. I tried to write the book in a very ecumenical, you know, generous way. I think it was generally that way, but there were certainly parts of the book that I think that if you were a kind of committed, dyed-in-the-wool Protestant, you might not like too much.
Okay, well, we will end with that. I wanted to thank Gary, thank Professor Anderson for a really illuminating and interesting conversation. And if you haven't yet read the book, so now you know that it's not thrilling tales of sinners past, but it is about something hopefully equally thrilling, history of the conceptualization of sin, which really brings us to some very fundamental theological questions. So friends, thank you for joining us, and be sure to be with us for the next episode of Minding Scripture, where divine word and human reason meet. Thank you.